Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Weed Wonks, the podcast that dives deep into the nerdy details, the minutiae, the ever-fun silliness that is cannabis regulatory policy. And we do it all to help our fellow policy wonks, policymakers, regulators, business members, advocates, and the canna curious stay more informed about the ever-changing landscape of cannabis laws and regulations. Please remember to rate, subscribe, and review. I'm your host, Jordan Wellington, managing partner of VS Strategies. As always, thanks to Rootworks for helping us make this podcast happen, and our amazing producer, Josh, for always making sure everything comes out just perfect. We have a really cool show today. I'm very excited. One of my favorite states to talk about and one of the most interesting states in cannabis policy is Massachusetts, one that a lot of folks on our team have had been involved with since really before the market even started, back from the initiative days for legalization. And so it's always nice to check in on what Massachusetts is doing on cannabis policy. They're a very deep thinking state, I feel like. And they really try to put a lot of thought into the rules and regulations that they put behind. And so in continuing our series on testing, this will be the last one for a minute, but testing obviously is always important. We have invited Commissioner Kimberly Roy to join us from the Massachusetts Cannabis Control Commission. She has been doing a lot of work on product safety and testing, but that's not the only thing she's been working on. She's been working on a ton of stuff. So we're going to talk about that first and then get into testing. But first and foremost, welcome to the show, Commissioner Roy. It's incredibly nice to have you on and appreciate you taking the time.
Well, thank you so much, Jordan, for inviting me. I'm excited to be on Weed Wonks today, and we'll get to it. We got a lot to cover,
and we're in the middle of a mega snowstorm. I feel like there's about 8 or 10 inches of snow already here in Denver. And so we're going to try to keep it short and sweet. Not my best skill set, as our listeners probably have realized at this point, but we're going to try to be hyper efficient today because I've got a 7-year-old that is very focused on dad and Batman at the moment. So we're going to try to get to dad time while he's got a snow day. But don't want to miss out on all the good nerdy stuff going on. So first and foremost, I guess you didn't get bored into the role as a cannabis control commissioner. You probably had a life before that. And so can we just talk a little bit about your background before you joined the Cannabis Control Commission?
Sure. And thank you for that, Jordan. Prior to becoming a commissioner, and now I've been serving as a commissioner for about 2.5 years, I sit in the public health seat. I was appointed by former Governor Charlie Baker. And why was I appointed by Governor Baker? I think my background lends itself to being a cannabis control commissioner. And what I mean by that is I served over a decade in the leadership team at a correctional facility, the Worcester County Sheriff's Office, where we focused on a lot of folks, unfortunately, are incarcerated due to substance use disorder. And unfortunately, I get to see up close, up front, what the opioid epidemic has done to folks, not only destroying lives, but destroying families. And I took my time there at the sheriff's office to create a curriculum along with the sheriff. It's called Face to Face. You can Google that, Face, number two, Face. And it talks about the myths and the facts of substance use. It's very cutting edge and very interactive. We use things that will hold young people's attention, like athletes and celebrities and how they went down that road. And it can be a direct path to prison or even worse. So based on that, in my prior experience, I worked in healthcare for Johnson & Johnson. I think I had a combination where the governor said, hey, former Commissioner Flanagan was moving on. And so he asked me if I would serve in this role. And it's been very interesting.
Yeah. And I think that, first of all, the background's fascinating. I think incredibly helpful to the work that you're doing and very informative. But also, I think it's a real milestone and marker of the times and evolution that we've achieved as a society. For someone who has the background that you've described, has worked in corrections, has worked in substance abuse, to be able to say, no, I want to work on overseeing regulated and legalized marijuana, a commercial industry, to help make sure it's being done safely. That's a shift in perspective, I think, that we've seen, not in one silo, not in one discipline, really across the board in policy and in public policy and in government, of folks understanding that, hey, you know, this is where society is going. This is what the people want. We're in a democracy and regulation works, right? That's what we like to say here is regulation works. And it's far better than prohibition from a public health perspective. And when we see folks with your background, folks with your experience coming to the table, that's how we know we've made progress, both in changing people's perspectives on how we can best address cannabis policy, but also how we can make the best policy. Because if we don't have folks with your background and your experience coming to the table and saying, okay, well, this is what I've seen, this is my expertise, this is how we can make really good policy to protect public health and safety, we're going to be lacking, skill sets and assets in trying to create the best public policy. So I really appreciate you taking the step. I know sometimes probably being a cannabis control commissioner can feel like a thankless job and can be a little bit frustrating. I talk to a lot of regulators and it's sometimes that's just the gig and it comes with it. But, you know, I at least from my perspective, I hope you feel the same way, that that sacrifice is very, very worth it, because the impact that you can have on public policy and people's lives is significant. And without folks like yourself, we'd really be missing that kind of lens of, you know, cannabis is a drug. It can lead to certain substance use disorders. Thankfully, it's less harmful than most other drugs, including alcohol, but that doesn't mean it's harmless, right? And what we need to do is give people good education to make good decisions about their lives so they can be good family members and good parents and good friends and be good community members for everybody around. So I really appreciate that. And I think it's really informative to a lot of the other topics we're going to talk about and the areas you focus and why you've driven in so deep and been so effective.
And thank you for that, Jordan. And a lot of us have had to evolve, right? The voters, the will of the voters in 2016 in Massachusetts was to legalize cannabis for adult use. And our previously, 4 years prior, the voters voted to have medical use. So how do we safely regulate this, right? It's a highly regulated, highly taxed product, but we want folks, consumers and patients to know that there's a difference between the legacy market and the regulated market, and your products are tested. And that's really important. And a lot of us had to evolve. You know, cannabis was always considered a gateway drug, right? That's what we heard for a long time. But what I'm finding as I meet with folks and veterans, particularly veterans who have used it for harm reduction, and who have cycled off of opioids and use cannabis now, and they're functioning. There's a veteran in the town over from me, and he's told his story publicly many times that he was served two tours. I think he was in Iraq and was put on a vicious cycle of opioids where he tried to take his life. And his wife said, no more, you're going to try cannabis. And he says, I'm going to try what? And he did. And it not only saved his life, but now he's an elected official. He's a business person. He's highly productive. And most importantly, he's a great husband and dad to his family. And so I'm hearing this story over and over again. And what led me, and I think you've asked me, Jordan, what else I've been working on, access for veterans. We are so grateful to all of them for the service and sacrifice to our country. And many of the veterans get their health care from the Veterans Administration. It's a federal health care system. And we all know cannabis is still federally illegal, right? Schedule one. So while they can start to have those conversations, their providers can't necessarily prescribe them as a cannabis medical patient. So I'm proud to have said that I sponsored veterans access on one of our meetings, and we voted unanimously to ask the legislature to allow veterans to go to the VA, get what's called a blue button report, which would identify their qualifying condition and just bring it directly to the commission so they can get certified as a patient. And that removes a barrier. You know, it can be costly, you know, a few hundred dollars to get certified. And why do we have to make our veterans go through that? They're already getting health care. They already have qualifying conditions. And we voted unanimously on that. And it's still in the legislature, but I'm really optimistic that it'll get through. And that's one of the things that I'm working on. You had mentioned young people with prevention and education. When I started as a commissioner, it was brought to my attention that the driving schools across Massachusetts and, quite frankly, the entire country, there was really no curriculum that addresses cannabis impairment behind the wheel. And I was shocked to learn this information. And there's much about not all young people know, don't drink and drive. And there's a breathalyzer. And if you blow 0.8, you're legally intoxicated behind the wheel. But we know the science isn't settled, right, to detect impairment on cannabis. But so in lieu of that, what can we do to help young people stay safe behind the wheel? So I formed a working group with AAA Northeast, in the Massachusetts RMV, which is our Registry of Motor Vehicles. And we had a DRE. We had a chief of police. We had a PhD out of UMass all join this working group, and along with another commissioner, Commissioner Stebbins. And we did it. And we put it together in a year. AAA had a foundation of a curriculum built called Shifting Gears, the Blunt Truth About Marijuana and Driving for health classes. And what they did was they generously donated that curriculum, but we changed it for Massachusetts. So it was consistent with our laws in Massachusetts. And it's not DARE. Let me just say that for your listeners. It's evidence-based. The curriculum, the first iteration was reviewed by Brown University for evidence-based. And it lets young people make good decisions behind the wheel. If you feel different, then you will drive different. And so Massachusetts, a little over a year ago, we announced that we were the first state in the nation to mandate this curriculum, the Blunt Truth About Marijuana Driving, in every Massachusetts driver's ed school. And last year, over 50,000 students got that curriculum. And since then, Connecticut has passed a law, Rhode Island's in the process, and many other states. So we want to keep young people safe. We're not stigmatizing cannabis. It's not DARE. It's not just say no. It's we want to keep you safe. I'm really proud of that.
Yeah, those are two unbelievable initiatives. And there's some others we want to get to. I don't want to give up my chance to just share how exciting I think really both of those things are. Veterans access is obviously a huge issue. And I think a hallmark of the progress that we've made, right? Recognition, like you had mentioned, you know, cannabis is a gateway drug. I went through DARE. I'm an 80s baby. So I got all the great Reagan era drug education that quickly identified by the time I was probably about 14 or 15 as most of it wasn't true and accurate. And you know, that does a significant disservice, I think, to young people because it erodes trust in everything else, right? And once you figure out they lied about cannabis and none of the things I was told about cannabis were actually true or even close to accurate when I was a kid, then you're like, well, what else were they lying about? And that's really scary when it comes to really dangerous, and more dangerous things like opiates. And you live in this world where, I mean, I remember I've gotten them. I remember when I got my wisdom teeth pulled out and they were like, here's a giant, you know, stack of pills and, you know, oh, you have this surgery, you have this, here's more pills, here's more pills. And I would even say to them, I'm not going to take those. Like they make me feel itchy. I hate it. Like I can just smoke a joint or eat an edible and it'll solve my problem without all of that. And they're like, I just take it anyway. Like just take it in case you need it. You know, and I think that that's a very dangerous reality that we're not thinking about drugs as they are, right? You have to regulate a drug to the truth of what it is. You have to be honest with people about the risks. You have to be evidence-based and you have to be clear. And that it resolves in access for veterans, right? Making sure we're taking roadblocks away because it can be a hassle to get to a doctor. It can be concerning to have all of these things happen and to remove those barriers because right now that barrier exists because of laws, federal prohibition, not really good justified public policy, right? If a doctor says to a veteran, this might help you or you have a condition that could be helped by cannabis, do we really need an extra doctor to say it's okay? Like from a public policy perspective, we don't. Under the current Byzantine structures of laws, we do. And so removing that barrier, I think, is huge. And educating young people, you know, in a very frank way, like, hey, don't, if you feel different, you're going to drive different. I love that phrase. I think that's a really, really good, catchy one. And it really gets down to the core of this, which is we're not saying do or don't do something. You're an autonomous person. You need to make decisions. And look, you tell a 14-year-old not to do something. It's the first thing they're immediately going to do. So it ain't going to help anyway. Exactly. Right. Be safe. And like driving a car is like probably the least safe, scariest thing most people will ever do in their lives. We don't think about it that way because we do it every day. But like you could really hurt somebody if you're not responsible in that activity. And so that kind of education is absolutely critical and a key part of why regulation works, right? Is when cannabis is illegal, a lot of the education is just don't do it. It's dangerous. If you regulate it, you kind of teach to the actual dangers and you're like, hey, you could really hurt somebody. You could hurt yourself. You could hurt other families. And that is about a message about responsibility and not abstinence, which I think is the most important thing.
And also, we had young people assist us in this. We had a high school do a semester-long research project. And they, what they did, these young people, is they went on every social media platform, you name it, they went on it to see the messaging to young people around cannabis and driving. And actually it was kind of destructive. It was saying, oh, you can drive better high, slower high. And that was the messaging out there. So this group of teens came back to us and they said, we implore you to do this. We need the right messaging because we're not getting that on our, where we get our news and our videos on social media. And so that was a big part of it for us, is they were getting no messaging about how to stay safe around cannabis. And again, we don't stigmatize. You know, there are a lot of young people with parents that are medical patients. There's none of that. It's just give them the facts and let them make good decisions.
Yeah. And that's not suggesting that we should change the age of consumption, right? The age of maturity. We're not trying to say teenagers should be consuming cannabis, because that's why we set the age at 21. But we're also not going to be ridiculous and put our head in the sand and say the teenagers aren't going to do this, right? Like,
that's right.
What we need to do is say, okay, we're strongly suggesting that you hold off for brain development and a variety of other reasons. But we also know that, you know, 16-year-olds are probably not like at the apex of decision-making in life. And they certainly don't listen to authority. And so we're going to say, oh, like, you probably shouldn't, but if you are, like, really don't get behind the wheel of a car. And we're going to leverage education and peer training and all the things. Because I think also, as you noted, the science isn't settled. You know, we've been working with a client here that does cognitive impairment assessment. And it's a really fascinating technology because it gets away from this idea of a blood test, right? Like, I woke up, I haven't even had my coffee yet. So that's probably going to impact my cognitive functioning. Apologies to the listeners. It's still a little early here, you know, I think the reality is I probably do have 5 nanograms of THC in my blood right now, and I'm not really concerned about my ability to drive a car. But if I were to consume an impairing amount of cannabis, like, probably might not change the readings of my blood, but my driving would be affected. And so we need to do two things, right? First and foremost, invest in education and invest in youth education and accessible education and non-judgmental education, all the things you're talking about. And then we also need to invest in technologies to figure out how we can really differentiate between those who are and aren't impaired on the roads. So we've talked about education for veterans. We've talked about education for young people in roadside safety. But I think there's another component of cannabis education that you've really invested time in. And I think as someone who actually has family that still lives on the Northeast, who might fall into this age bracket population, thinking of my father, you know, there's another aspect of cannabis education, another group of folks that you're working on trying to help understand the realities of cannabis. And can you talk a little bit about that work? Because I think that work is just so unbelievably important.
Sure. Thank you, Jordan. So also, when I became a commissioner, I was looking at what demographics really are starved for information around cannabis, but are kind of curious. And I think you use that line at the beginning when you open the show. And I use that line quite often. And I found that older Americans have a lot of questions and they're highly curious. So the communications team at the commission, along with myself, we created a really informative educational presentation. I just did it a couple weeks ago. I'm going to do it in Gardner, Mass. I'm going to go to Concord, Mass. In a few weeks. So I've done it all over the state. It's always very well attended. And it talks about the medical program, how to become a medical patient, because if you don't know, and some older Americans don't have access to the internet or computer savvy. So we bring the necessary medical forms. We talk about the adult use side, and we talk about the history and the timeline that, you know, in 2012, the medical program was voted in 2016. Question 4, adult use became legal. The commission was stood up in 2017. And then the first stores opened in the fall of 2018. And we talk about, you know, simple things. I'll ask a question. Everybody's heard of gummies and edibles. Like, everybody raises their hand. And then I say, do you know the onset of action or when you will feel the effects of a gummy? And nobody raises their hand because they don't know. There's a delayed onset of action because it goes through your stomach. And it could be a couple of hours before you feel the effects of a cannabis gummy. So education is super important. I get so many questions. A big one, and I did listen to one of your previous podcasts, is what's the difference between hemp and THC? And I explained to them it's 0.3 or less, it's hemp, and it's above, it's THC. The commission regulates in Massachusetts, the Cannabis Control Commission regulates THC, Delta 9. We do not regulate hemp or Delta 8. And so that's a big conversation that's popping up everywhere in gas stations and convenience stores. It's unregulated. Quite frankly, in my research, I've seen unsavory ingredients like acetone, which your listeners know is fingernail polish remover or formaldehyde, and some really unsavory things can be found in some of these untested products. So we talk about the difference. And if you go into a dispensary that's regulated by us, you know your products are safe. They all have a certificate of analysis. And I think you said that you should be all one. I think I heard you say, Jordan, right? That cannabis.
Yeah, it's all right. Marijuana and hemp are legal fictions. They're not real. It's all the cannabis plant. The THC is THC, and I think we just need to regulate cannabis. And if you are making something that gets you high, I just like to be silly about it. And we're going to call all the stuff that gets you high weed. And if you have weed shit, it gets you high. We're going to regulate it like a drug. And if it doesn't get you high, then it's not weed. And we're not going to regulate it that way. And this idea of, I think one of the ones we had in Minnesota, which was my favorite when I was talking to Jason Tarasek, and we were talking about how you can have a 5 milligram THC cannabis beverage, whether that's made from marijuana or hemp, it's still a cannabis beverage. If you drive into Wisconsin, and that cannabis beverage was made with THC extracted from a plant that had 0.3% or less THC, dry weight by volume, tested multiple weeks before harvest, or maybe not at all, then it's totally legal and no one can arrest you and you're totally fine. But if that exact same product with the exact same amount of THC, with identical chemical structures that will impact a human being in the exact same way, was extracted from a cannabis plant with more than 0.3% THC, dry weight by volume, then you're a horrendous criminal who needs to be put in a cage. And that is the current state of federal cannabis policy. And I think educating seniors about this is just so important, because those questions that they're asking are completely legitimate questions, right? And they're real public safety issues. If you don't understand that an edible is going to have a delayed onset, you could engage in stacking and all of a sudden, you know, in take too much. And, you know, one of the jokes that we like to make about drug use is like, you could always take more, but you could never take less, right? Like once it's in there and you're just on the ride. And so go slow. We say start low, go slow. First time five, all these different kitschy things that we're saying to just try to encourage people to say, hey, wait a minute, like take your time. It's not a race. Like, and be patient, because sometimes an edible will take a long time to kick in. And the last thing in your world you want to do is say, oh, this isn't working, I'm going to take more. And then all of a sudden, 2 hours later, you're really not in a place where you're comfortable, right? And that's where safety issues can arise.
Exactly. And another point I try to stress is when they grew up, cannabis was stigmatized, and the potency might have been lower years ago than it is now. And so it's not that we always joke, it's not your grandfather's cannabis, but it's not. And in we have higher potency amounts, and we have different forms of ingestion now. And in nano emulsions, you know, that's kind of a newer thing where you may look like a gummy, but it's going to have a rapid onset of action. So education is critically important. And as a commissioner, when we get licenses in front of us, every month and we approve them, I always, I sit in the public health seat. So I look at their consumer education, and if it's missing anything, I put a condition on there. Just so it needs to be readily available to consumers. And, you know, we could have game changers down the road. It could get descheduled or rescheduled. Or, you know, years ago, I remember insurance companies wouldn't cover acupuncture, but maybe 10 years from now, guess what? Maybe they'll cover cannabis. And that would be a game changer. But we need to get, in the meantime, we need to get education out there, whether it's young people, whether it's new users, whether it's older Americans. And that's really been a driving force for me.
Yeah. And then I don't want to belabor it, but the hemp stuff you mentioned is also a huge issue, because it's very confusing messaging. Like, I understand it soup to nuts. My parents, if they're confused about something, they have the fortunate ability to call me and be like, Jordan, what the heck's going on here? But I think for a lot of folks, and you read really scary stories about people, you know, accidentally, unknowingly giving their kid a hemp product, which is not sold in any special way. And the next thing you know, they're in the hospital with their kid, and Child Protective Services is like, why did you give your kid weed? And they're like, what are you talking about? And like, I could not possibly think of a more terrifying experience than being in a hospital with your child. And then all of a sudden you turn around, Child Protective Services is like asking you these kinds of questions. I mean, it's just a horrific thing. And education is the pathway forward. And so in that framing, I think there's been some other really major initiatives that you've worked on that I want to touch on before we get to, well, maybe we'll have about 10 minutes for testing here, but a lot of this stuff is so fun. I don't think we could just skip over it. And so two major other initiatives going on in Massachusetts. One is HCA reform. I know you're working on, you've just finished those model regulations. HCAs are in some ways unique in Massachusetts. In some ways, it's like just a different flavor of the same kind of thing. Like we have significant issues around, HCA agreements, for those who don't know, are host community agreements between a business and its host community. And it essentially functions as both conditions for licensure and a form of local taxation. Right. So in Colorado, we don't have host community agreements, but you best believe Denver has all kinds of rules and regulations that oversee cannabis businesses. And Denver taxes the absolute hell out of cannabis businesses. In fact, at rates far greater than anything that would be recommended as reasonable in Massachusetts under the reform. So I think you talk a little bit about that, and then let's shift into the governor's pardons real quick, because that's kind of breaking news for the day we're recording it. And then We'll take a couple minutes to talk about the testing initiatives too.
Sure. Thank you, Jordan. HCA is a host community agreement, and it's in statute, and it was from day one when legalization passed. And it was to offset impacts, because people didn't know what the impacts were going to be by allowing cannabis entities into their communities. So it was almost to incentivize communities to open their arms, welcome in these licensees into their communities. But what happened was the commission, the Cannabis Control Commission, Massachusetts, we just checked the box that you had an HCA. We didn't have the jurisdiction to prove and regulate them. So what was happening, and I euphemistically say it was the Wild West of host community agreements, because a lot of stuff was going on, and no disrespect to the West, because I think it's beautiful and I love it. But really, there were a lot of things going on, upfront payments, donations that were mandated over the 3%. Folks couldn't get a receipt for where their community impact fee monies were being spent. There was litigation recently in Uxbridge, Massachusetts, and the community of Uxbridge, Massachusetts refunded a licensee $1.2 million and stopped collecting them altogether. So we heard my first few years, a couple years as a commissioner, about the unlevel playing field of host community agreements. The host community had all the leverage and all the power. And quite frankly, many of these, and I read many of them, were contracts of adhesion. And so the legislature passed Chapter 180. It was an equity bill. It was the first time that they revisited cannabis since it passed in 2016. And Governor Baker signed that into law in November of 2022. And the commission had 1 year to convert legislation into regulation and to vote on it and to promulgate it. And we did that. And we met with a lot of stakeholders, both the municipalities and the licensees. And we put a really thoughtful regulatory scheme together. And basically what we did is we didn't favor any one side. We just leveled the playing field. And we defined reasonably related, right? That was the million-dollar question. What is reasonably related? Well, it has to be a direct nexus between the licensee operating in the community and impacting goods or services, a need for more services or goods in that community. So we defined that. We got rid of upfront payments, extra donations, bad faith dealings. We got rid of all of that. And then we created a model host community agreement, which we just ratified as a commission last week, that says this is the template. If you want to be in compliance and you are struggling to come to terms, you can turn to this template, Model HCA, and you will automatically be in compliance. Having said all that, every licensee still one renewal needs to have a compliant HCA. We are calling balls and strikes, though. So if we see community impact fees and you're going to pay for Little League uniforms, I don't know how that's necessarily
probably an impact, not.
And that would be called out. So we get to review, certify, and approve these host community agreements, and we've leveled the playing field. And quite frankly, cannabis has been an economic driver in Massachusetts, hundreds of millions of dollars in sales and excise tax combined. It outpaces alcohol, believe it or not, an excise tax. It is now the top crop in Massachusetts. Massachusetts is known for cranberries, which is a wonderful crop, but now cannabis outpaces it as the top crop in Massachusetts. It's created thousands and thousands of jobs. It's converted old mill buildings that were sitting vacant into now thriving cultivation sites or retail sites. So it's done a lot for real estate as well. So having said that, we can't make it so it's untenable to do business either. And those host community agreements were really, as I said, contracts of adhesion. And now it's level. The playing field has been leveled.
I mean, I think what's so amazing about all of this is, without belaboring the issue, Massachusetts went from a state that had a reputation of a challenging relationship with local governments around these host community agreements, of one that was not level playing field and could even be described in certain circumstances as exploitative, right? And I think this gets to a point that I always like to make, is that all of this money comes from people who consume cannabis, right? All this money is because someone woke up one day and said, I want to go buy some cannabis. All the commissioner's money, all the regulator's money, all the money my family makes, it all comes from the same place. And so the cannabis consumer needs to be treated fairly and equitably. And if there are outside costs, those need to be paid through taxes and fees. That's completely fair. But if it is an unreasonably related thing, then that is inequitable to the cannabis consumer, which is where all this money is coming from. And in fact, Massachusetts has gone from a state where that was a reputation of a problem to a state of a model. Because I can tell you here right now, cannabis consumers in Denver are not treated equitably. We have an effective tax rate of close to 40%, which is crazy for a Western, you know, state. And I know for a fact that a large amount of the state's money and a large amount of Denver's money would not be reasonably related under any rational analysis, but that's how government budgets are. And so I think it's just really cool to highlight the fact that this was an area where Massachusetts had a reputation for being, let's say, below average in terms of the equitability of this, to one where they are an example of reform and what other states should be following in terms of how they should be looking at this. And one, as a person who lives in Denver, would wish our city would follow, because I think we sorely, sorely need it. All right, real quick, breaking news. What happened around these pardons with the governor?
So yesterday, I had the privilege and opportunity to go to the State House in Boston. Governor Maura Healey announced yesterday that she is blanket pardoning in perpetuity back all misdemeanor marijuana convictions. And that was huge news. And in the estimates the governor shared with us yesterday, it will impact over 100,000 folks will have their records pardoned. And as we know, President Biden in October, I believe it was 2023, had issued pardons for federal simple marijuana possession crimes, misdemeanors, and he asked governors to do the same. So yesterday was an historic day, very well attended ceremony. As a matter of fact, we had two licensees who are in our social equity program who are doing very well in the cannabis industry, highly successful now, but both had passed records. So this was a big deal for them in high school. And one of them, their conviction in high school prevented them from joining their dream to join the military. So it just shows you it can impact something like that, joining the military, housing, education, employment opportunities. So in Massachusetts, we have what's called the Governor's Council. So the Governor Healey announced it yesterday that the blanket pardon will apply automatically. Folks don't have to do a thing. It's automatically going to happen. And it will be for misdemeanor marijuana convictions, but it has to go in front of the Governor's Council. Any of her pardons, just like any of her judicial nominees, have to get green-lighted by the Governor's Council. But for what I'm hearing and reading, I think they're very supportive of this. And, you know, having worked in a correctional facility, I understand that giving folks the tools they need and giving folks opportunity to succeed and to be productive, when that happens, we all win, right? When folks are doing well and barriers are removed and opportunities, doors open, society wins as a whole. So yesterday was a big day to in Massachusetts, and the first state in the country to issue this blanket pardon.
Yeah, and I can't agree with you more. It's so important that we do this work. You know, one of the realities of cannabis reform is, you know, it kind of feels in a lot of ways like a mea culpa of society, right? Like, hey, cannabis was legal for the vast majority of human history. We had a blip of 100 years of prohibition, and we're kind of realizing that was a huge mistake from a policy perspective. And the people who were harmed by that mistake, harmed by the war on drugs, we don't want them to continue suffering to the greatest extent we can. And pardons by governors across the country, pardons by President Biden. We worked on legislation here to help Governor Polis issue a lot of pardons. You know, these are an important step in remedying that mistake as part of that mea culpa. And I'm really excited to hear that Massachusetts is moving forward in addressing some of those things. So, okay, so now we've set the stage on all of these amazing things. We're running out of time, obviously, but there are some really important things relating to testing that have been going on in Massachusetts. And you've been working really hard on trying to improve the testing program, to improve product safety and consumer information and education, which relates to a lot of things we've been talking about. So can you share with us some of those testing related initiatives that you've been working on?
Sure. And Jordan, and thank you for that. And just let me say, this isn't a Massachusetts problem. It really is a nationwide problem around testing. You can Google potency inflation and a myriad of states will come up. I know California has had a big issue with that. So potency inflation is really... it really is an issue that is nationwide, industry-wide. And in Massachusetts, also, we have what's called lab shopping. So we have independent testing labs in Massachusetts. We have 16 that have commenced operations. When we started, we only had two. And in Massachusetts was unique. We inherited, when it was approved for medical use in 2012, the Department of Public Health oversaw the cannabis industry. And then when adult use was created, the Cannabis Control Commission was formed, and the DPH model lifted and shifted over to the Cannabis Control Commission. And at the time, there were two labs testing everything. So they created an a la carte rule, which says if you want to send a sample to one lab to test potency and pesticides, and another lab to test for pathogens, you can do that. Now, that is kind of inherently problematic because you're shopping around to find the favorable lab. And another thing that's inherently problematic in Massachusetts is we do not have a standards lab. Other states refer to it as a reference lab. And many states do not have that. But where the conflict lies is we regulate those 16 independent testing labs. We do surprise inspections. We do scheduled inspections. We issue notices of deficiency. And yet when we need confirmatory testing, we have to turn to them as a vendor, and they have skin in the game, if you will. And it's just inherent with conflicts. It's really problematic. So what can we do in lieu of the fact that we don't have this confirmatory testing state-run lab? So our friends to the north in Vermont, and I just had shared this with my colleagues last meeting, they have had an appropriation from their legislature for $1.2 million. Well, they will hire a couple of folks. I believe they're chemists. They will have different machines, equipment to test for pesticides and pathogens and potency. And they will have a state-run lab, which will keep folks honest and will keep the industry honest, because the last thing we want is products to be mislabeled, claiming a higher potency. Now, if you're a cancer patient, if you have an autoimmune disease, if you are compromised and you are using cannabis as your medicine and you think you're getting a certain potency because you need that efficacy and that is mislabeled just so it can be charged, you can charge more money for it, that is wrong. And so we need to take steps because we want everybody to be in compliance, and we want honest labeling, and we need folks to be honest brokers. And another thing we're doing is, so I'm advocating for a standards reference lab, but also we have in our regulations what's called a secret shopper program, where the commission or a designee of the commission can go in and purchase products. And we can have confirmatory testing to see if they're accurate. So I've had a really great meeting this week with a lot of folks in the room. And we are on our way forward to start to build that program and execute. So we're getting there. We're not there yet, but we are close. And I'm really excited about that. Another thing we've done Jordan, is when I started, I advocated for standardization because you have 16 labs that are calculating potency differently, and some are PCR testing, and it's different forms of testing. And what can we do to standardize that? So the commission issued a bulletin in November, and there was a few questions regarding need a little more edification. And last week they reissued it with the updates. And what they did was they codified how to calculate the potency with the THC, THCA, Delta 9. And they have a formula now that everybody has to use, and everybody has to use it as received. So it's all getting standardized. They have 30 days to start to implement, 30 business days to start to implement this. And this is what we need. We need consistency. Even the certificates of analysis, they should be standardized. I believe in sunshine and open data. All the metric data, which is our seed to sale tracking program, that should be public because the industry can look for anomalies and they will point it out if they see, you know, some hanky-panky going on with testing. So we're taking steps. We are being vigilant, and we want safe products at the end of the day.
So all of those initiatives that you're working on, Commissioner Roy, are just so unbelievably important relating to product safety. And it gets back to a lot of these education issues that we're talking about, a lot of these product safety and public safety issues, right? We need to make sure that consumers are educated. We've talked a lot about consumer education. And obviously, we don't want inflated and false potency scores on products. But those are businesses reacting to market conditions, right? Consumers make purchasing decisions based entirely on potency scores, when that is actually not the most relevant piece of information. Frequently, science will show us that terpenes have a much greater modulating effect on how high someone gets. And so people are looking and shopping based purely on potency scores. And that is driving this economic behavior by businesses to inflate scores, because that's what they're incentivized to do. And while we absolutely need programs to try to ensure that potency scores are absolutely valid and accurately reported to consumers, we also need to educate consumers about what they're looking for. We need to remove that incentive that businesses have as much as possible to inflate those scores, because that's not actually what consumers are looking for. Consumers should be looking for well-cultivated product that has low numbers of contaminants in it, product that's trimmed well, product that's well handled and maintained, potentially businesses that have ethical business practices or businesses that engage in giving back to their community. Those are things that should be driving purchasing decisions, not just a THC score. But that is the reality of the market today, and we're seeing businesses respond to that. And so while we need to get the businesses to obviously knock that behavior off because it's not helping anybody, at the same time, we also need to also treat the root cause through the educational programs and expanding those programs to help consumers really understand what is in the cannabis plant. We also need to deal with the reality that it is a plant. At its core, it is not a manufactured product. And so if you buy a box of cereal and it says this is the amount of calories per serving, they can engineer that product to be very consistent every single time. If you were to go into a store and test a series of Colorado, we like to use peaches, but Massachusetts, we can use cranberries. And you were to test the sugar content of every cranberry in the store cultivated by the same grower, that every cranberry of the same type wouldn't have the same amount of sugar in it. Every peach, even grown by the same grower, the same Palisade peach to use Colorado, doesn't have the same sugar content. It is a biological product. And in fact, some studies and some scientists have said that you can have a variation of like 20%. So if you have a flower at the top of a cannabis plant that's to 25% THC, you could have a flower at the very bottom, the larfy stuff that's not typically shelf flower, could be as low as 5%. How do you deal with accurately conveying information to a consumer when you have to deal with the variability of biology? All these initiatives are so important to make sure that we're able to educate consumers to make good decisions, that consumers can make defensible decisions, that people who are using medical cannabis know what they're consuming, but also know the limitations of science, right? There's a variability of potency scores, even in testing methodology. Even if you're doing everything correctly, you can have variability in potency scores. And so, yes, we need to make sure businesses are not engaging in shenanigans, but we also need to educate consumers about both the reality of the plant and what they should be looking for, and the limitations of testing as well, so they can make good decisions, because that at its core is part of the key here, is that We need to empower adults to make the best decisions for themselves and the best decisions for their lives. And we can't necessarily control all of it. You know, there aren't cannabis standards. There aren't standardized methods. Having a reference lab is an amazing thing. And if you can combine all of these incredible initiatives that you've been working on and bring all of that consumer education you're working on and extend it to these kinds of topics, I think that is getting us to the absolute best that we can do. And it's just wonderful to hear about all the amazing progress that you're making in Massachusetts, and maybe even more importantly, the dedication and focus that the Massachusetts Cannabis Control Commission has to improving these things and making them better. Because the reality is everything that you're working on, as great as it is not the end of that road. There are additional initiatives that are going to need to be undertaken. And the important thing is the diligence to continue to improve. And the Massachusetts Cannabis Control Commission and the work that you've talked about today really shows us with that. So Commissioner Roy, thank you so much. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate you taking the time today.
Thank you so much, Jordan, for having me on your show, Weed Wonks. I thoroughly enjoy our conversation and I look forward to coming back sometime if you have me.
No problem. Really appreciate it and look forward to future conversations and more great work for Massachusetts. And with that, we'll just say, stay nerdy, everybody.